Greetings. Welcome back to Media Matters. I'm your host today, Bob McChesney, here on WILL AM 580, University of Illinois station in Urbana, Illinois. It's my pleasure to be coming to you live, and our guest today joining us is one of the most astute observers of the internet and popular culture and the media culture. His name is Douglas Rushkoff. He's the author of 9 best-selling books on new media and popular culture, including Media Virus, Hidden Agendas in Popular Culture, Coercion, Why We Listen to What They Say, and the recent Nothing Sacred, The Truth About Judaism. Rushkoff's commentaries appear on CBS's Sunday Morning, NPR's All Things Considered, and on the back page of Time magazine. He writes for PBS, Channel 4, and does documentaries for them, as well as the BBC, and was the producer of the award-winning Frontline documentary, The Merchants of Cool. Recently, he authored a timely e-book titled Open Source Democracy, How Online Communication is Changing Offline Politics. Welcome to Media Matters, Douglas Rushkoff.
Hi, great to be with you.
It's really a pleasure to have you here, and I should let our listeners know at the outset that I had the privilege of meeting Douglas, it was almost 4 years ago, if I'm not mistaken, 3.5 years ago, when you were making the documentary, The Merchants of Cool for PBS, and you interviewed me. And I must tell you, I don't think I've ever done anything that's gotten so much recognition from people as being in that documentary.
Yeah, it's kind of wild, isn't it? I was pleased to see that people are watching PBS, you know.
Yeah.
Sometimes I think of it as the dark, you know, nether regions of the cable channel or the cable universe. But, you know, PBS is still a major network, and it seems that a lot of teachers were really moved by that documentary and wanted to show it to their students, and it ended up being one of the few programs that teachers showed their students that the kids actually responded to. You know, it wasn't some old 16-millimeter film of, you know, how to milk cows or something.
You know, you're absolutely right. I mean, I know it's used widely now in classes, and for listeners who are not familiar with it, if they go to your website, is there information on that documentary, Douglas?
They're pretty easy links from rushkoff.com to the actual place on frontline.org. The cool thing about Frontline now is they let you stream the entire documentary for free, you know, so people can just sit and watch the thing. But I guess the thing that made that documentary stick in people's heads was we did a really simple deconstruction of MTV. You know, we used you to show, you know, who owns this big company and, you know, what is this name on debt? And then we looked at the programming itself to show that this isn't programming, this is advertising, and even the programming that looks as if it's the programming between the advertising is actually still just advertising, you know, masquerading as one thing or another. So when kids actually see the sort of the feedback loop going on there, when they realize that the things that they thought were programs were actually sponsored media, their jaws drop, and it kind of changes their perspective on media.
Yeah, it's really an outstanding documentary. I think, though, that the thing that has gained you the most attention over the years, and certainly my attention, how I've used you in my own classes and own work, is your writing on the Internet. And, you know, the Internet, it seems like it's been around in popular mind maybe for, 15 years at the outside now.
Yeah.
And and you've been writing about it for the entirety of that period. At the same time, it's changed. It's probably had like a 1,000-year history in 15 years. And I see that when I look at your own work, starting with Media Virus in Siberia, then going through to Coercion, and now your new book on the Internet, Open Source Democracy. Because you went, I think, correct me if I'm incorrect, Douglas, but if I'm not mistaken, you started off, you know, this is a revolution and a really pretty good thing happening here, pretty exciting, to sort of a much more skepticism by the end of the 90s about exactly how great a revolution and how positive it'd be. And now it seems like you're coming back to saying, okay, there is something here.
Yeah, I mean, in a way, I guess my enthusiasm for the Internet is sort of, disproportional to the success of business online. You know, I was originally excited about the Internet less, I think, because of the Internet itself than because of the way the experience of the Internet changes the way people interact with the world around them. You know, I grew up in the age of passive media, in the age of television, and I think because we related to media as, you know, this sort of gospel truth piped into our homes, I think that gave us a certain relationship to our lawmakers, to our priests and ministers, to our teachers, to our medical authorities. Really, the world around us seemed programmed in a certain way, and by someone smarter or more important than we are. The experience of the Internet for me and for, you know, many of the kids who were first experiencing it in the late 80s and early 90s, you know, came along with the experience of the computer, which taught us, hey, you know, the world we're living in has been programmed by people. You know, that this is not the way things are. This is the way things have been designed. And we all, in one way or another, have access to the programs by which we all live. So I was very excited about the Internet that sort of I spoke about the Internet the way, you know, Timothy Leary used to speak about LSD, that all you need to do is have this experience of the world, play with computers, go online, move around from place to place, get your own news, and make your own news, experience yourself as not just a deconstructor of media, but as a creator of media, and the world will be different forever. But by 94, 95, 96, I realized that the story of the Internet had changed. It was no longer something in the lifestyle sections or the science sections of the newspaper. It was something in the business sections. And the Internet really had become a pyramid scheme, a way for people to make money. And the Internet experience had really been kind of downgraded to the experience of an electronic strip mall. So I got sad, and the things I was railing out against never were interactivity, but against the people or institutions that seemed to monopolize that space. But, you know, luckily they failed. You know, by the year 2000, you know, the dot-com bust had happened, and everyone said the Internet was over, so I celebrated, because the minute they think it's over is the minute that we can get back toward, you know, building this this kind of a community networking engine. And lo and behold, we're now in the age of blogs, you know, weblogs that people write themselves, of Meetup, which is a friend of mine's company that has allowed, you know, a candidate like Howard Dean to really move ahead of the pack, not by getting top-down money, but by getting bottom-up money and bottom-up organization. So, yeah, I'm optimistic again about at least what the Internet experience can do to the people who have it.
We're talking to Douglas Rushkoff today in Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney. Douglas Rushkoff is the author of numerous books on culture and the Internet and media. Most recently, the book Open Source Democracy, the e-book, How Online Communication is Changing Offline Politics, which we've just been talking about. Also, another book I hope to talk about today in this hour, Nothing Sacred, The Truth About Judaism. If you'd like to call in and speak with us today on Media Matters, the number is 333-9455, our toll-free number, 1-800-222-9455. And now this ebook, Open Source Democracy, How Online Communication is Changing Offline Politics. Let's talk about that. But before we do, how can people get a copy of this if it's an ebook?
Well, they can get it for free. It's actually an ebook and a real book. So,
oh, I've got it down just as an ebook. Okay, it's a real book.
If they want a real book, they can pay $5 to a place called Demos in the UK. It's actually a think tank that was developed around England's version of what were they called, the Bill Clinton sort of that democratic group that he came out of, that sort of we're going to be Democrats but we're going to be in the middle.
Leadership Council, or
right.
DLC.
Sort of, right. It came out of a UK equivalent of a DLC that then lost their way as Tony Blair, you know, sort of became something other than a Labour Party, other than a lefty, and they looked to reinvigorate themselves. They looked for a new mandate, this little think tank. So they had meetings with a bunch of people, and then they decided that their new mandate will really be this sort of electronic democracy and what that all means for the future. So they asked me if I would write a little book for them, which I did, called Open Source Democracy, which is available on their website as a download. It's something called a PDF, but most people have the ability to see those now, and if you don't, it's a free program to download too. So you would go to demos.co.uk, which is a UK website, and you'll get this little book. It's like a little 50-page book that I wrote, looking at how the metaphor of open source, this idea that everyone can contribute to the program, that the best kinds of programs evolve and have everyone has access to the codes. It's not hidden. It's not encrypted. It's something that anybody can work on, anybody can improve, and anyone can publicize and then distribute it themselves. That to me is one of the oldest things in the book. I mean, that's the Talmud, really. That's the way, you know, the Jews got started with their literature. But it's also the democratic process. And how can all of this networking technology really enhance and help us articulate a democratic process, not just a vote.com website where everybody just clicks on the boxes, you know, or people going into polling sites using computers instead of ballot boxes, but people actually getting online and feeding back, sharing what is their understanding of the law, what would they like it to be, and looking at much more, in some ways complex, but really just participatory models for democratic participation.
A few weeks ago, Douglas Rushkoff, we had as a guest Representative Bernie Sanders of Vermont. And Bernie Sanders was talking on a number of subjects. One of the things he spoke about most passionately was the influence of big money over politics in the United States, both in campaigns and then once candidates are actually elected in Washington, and how most Americans, even the most cynical and skeptical Americans, underestimate the power of big money basically to call all the shots on every issue of importance in Washington that affects us. And, you know, one of the questions that comes up as I hear you talk is, how much you think this open source democracy, the use of the internet in our political campaign and our politics, can undermine the power of money? Can you talk about that a little bit?
It's going to be tricky. It's funny. It's hard to figure out exactly where to start any investigation of what's going on or the power structures. But if you look at it very simply and figure, okay, there are these giant corporations that are nursing their debt and need money, and they buy influence by paying for campaigns from the top and by owning the media, which then covers those campaigns in more or less whatever way that they want them to be covered. It's very hard to think on how a candidate who might want to fight our oil policy, our drug policy, our farming policy, or any of our other policies that are basically corporate run, and now especially where the people who are administrating the agencies that are supposed to be watchdogging corporations are now handpicked from the lobbyists for those corporations, it's very hard to think of a way in, especially since it seems as if we're walking around in a world where no one even knows this is going on. You know, they're just watching their Fox News or whatever, you know, mainstream news channel and not even getting the information. So it seems that on the first hand, the internet can undermine sort of the corporate monopoly on information. So now instead of having to look to one of the major networks or one of the major magazines, you can go online and find authoritatively reported stories, even if you just go as far as the BBC online or the CBC up in Canada. You know, and you can read stuff that looks just like American writing. You know, it's nice, easy to read English, but it's giving some very alternative points of view on the news of the day, or places like Alternet and other alternative news sources with admittedly more progressive or critical bent on what's going on. So you don't need to find a copy of The Nation or Mother Jones somewhere to get information that's going to be in coverage that's going to be more critical of corporate America. But it also, the internet provides people ways, and this is the thing I think that's more important, to begin typing themselves. You know, I've always said a kid is using the internet right if his hand is off the mouse and on the keyboard. You know, that what I want to see is people believing that their thoughts and their expressions matter. We don't even have a culture like England where people argue in the pub about politics. People don't feel competent to have an opinion, and they defer the authority to anyone else who wants to take it. If people go online and start participating in forums, they start to realize that their brains are actually good enough, qualified enough to have important opinions, that they might actually come up with ideas for things that haven't been thought of by someone else. You know, a kid with a blog can bring down you know, Trent Lott, or make enough of a stink so that, you know, the Republicans have to apologize for something, or, you know, Matt Drudge, basically another kid with a website who opens up the Monica Lewinsky scandal. So the internet as a source of news information and as a place where people can begin to report and analyze themselves, it seems to me that's the most important thing. Then second would come people like Dean or other candidates who are now using the internet to reach directly to people without throwing a big, you know, $1,500 a plate party. You can say, this is my website, this is my campaign, you know, come and contribute. And people of all ages will contribute $10 or $20. And it's these tiny contributions that are adding up and giving Dean the big head start he has in money. And it'd be very interesting if he became a candidate with, you know, $100 million $10 contributions versus another candidate with $100 million contributions. You know, what would that look like?
All right.
You know, and in some sense, it's a much more democratic way of raising your money.
We're talking to Douglas Rushkoff today on Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney. Douglas Rushkoff is the author of numerous books, including the recent book, Open Source Democracy, How Online Communication is Changing Offline Politics, and also Nothing Sacred, The Truth About Judaism. The number here at Media Matters, 333-9455 is our local number. Our toll-free number, 1-800-222-9455. The lines are open. Please call in if you have any questions or comments. Let's talk a little bit about the Dean campaign. You've mentioned it several times now. I don't know if you formally have a dog in the Democratic race or in the political race this year, but what's your assessment of the political situation in the United States, independent of the internet, and then sort of put the Dean campaign in that context?
Well, you know, I don't really have a horse. I would like to be for I can't even say his name, Kucinich.
Yeah, Kucinich.
Kucinich. I'd like to be for him just because he's like, so he's actually quite radically progressive. I didn't realize it because he's so mild mannered, but I started reading his actual positions on things. I mean, he makes Dean, you know, look conservative by comparison. What I'm interested in, and it's again, I have a very tilted point of view. You know, a friend of mine based this website called Meetup.com. He based it on some ideas I wrote in a book called Media Virus about bottom-up networking and how bottom-up networking only matters if people use it finally to meet up face-to-face. You know, that it's a means to an end, but not an end in itself. And he was looking at the internet and said, well, you know, what you said is right, but there's never been a tool on the internet for people to really just meet up face-to-face, you know, other than dating or silly little things like that. So he thought, well, if he could create a tool, an engine that let people meet up, this could actually change people's relationship to politics and to self-organizing. So the reason why Dean feels like my horse in this particular race was really because he's using a tool that I was a part of developing. So I'm very interested in his organization. The strange thing is, I don't know, and perhaps callers will know, you know, better than I, as I read his actual his issues and his stance on things, I wonder how much people's real positions are related to their use of media. In other words, would I support a candidate who I don't agree with them on the issues, but I so agree with their use of media that then they become my candidate? It's kind of interesting. So you almost have to start to wonder, are these candidates true to their media campaigns, or are they just using, you know, a new state-of-the-art transparent media to do the same old thing? You know, that's sort of where that's where I'm watching.
Mm-hmm.
You know, from my own little place as a media theorist, and I realize that in a sense the what I'm succumbing to is something that I fear a lot of us in America may succumb to, which is it's really just judging a candidate by their commercials one way or the other. So here I am saying, oh, I really like Dean because of this and because of that, and I realize the things I'm saying are completely divorced from the candidate's issues. They only deal with the way in which he's raised money or the way in which he's using technology or media, and that may not really go down to the core of his of his real working strategies.
We're talking to Douglas Rushkoff today in Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney. The number here, 333-9455. The toll-free number, 1-800-222-9455. Let's go to the phone lines now. Champagne, you're on the air with Douglas Rushkoff.
Hello, Douglas. Hello, Robert.
Bonjour.
Hey.
I wanted to say that regarding Dean, Howard Dean, and his campaign, yes, remarkable the way he used, for the first time, I think, that avenue of Internet. However, I voted for Bill Clinton because Bill Clinton stepped up and closed his mouth and listened to the questions, listened to the concerns of his Democrat constituents. Howard Dean never closes his mouth, not even when he's not talking. Howard Dean never closes his mouth, even when he's not talking. Thank you very much.
Well, it's interesting. I mean, on the one hand, I understand what the caller's talking about. On the other hand, you know, Bill Clinton came from the world of Dick Morris. You know, he came from a world of pollsters. And there's a certain point at which you have to wonder, do we want our politicians to use media in that way, that they're just listening and then feeding back to the public what it is they think the public wants to hear? Or is that over now? Have we realized that the democratic process involves something more than polling and responding to polls, but actually involves electing an individual who has a point of view and who has a strategy independent of what the numbers might be saying?
So you're not necessarily buying into the idea that Clinton was especially sincere as he listened to the people.
I don't buy into the idea that anybody is really listening to the people. No, I think when I look at the kinds of marketing and focus groups and studies that Bush's people have done during the war and the kind of polling that they do all the way back to Dick Morrison before, it looks to me exactly like what MTV does or what Procter & Gamble does. You know, they hold focus groups not because they're trying to figure out what it is that the people around that table, these people who represent the public, not what they need, not what they want, but what could be sold to them. And those are very different things. If you get a bunch of kids around the table talking to MTV executives, the MTV executives say, okay, kids, what is it you really want? They said, we want to have parties in our houses. We really want to buy less stuff. We want to hang out with each other. Okay, next. Mm-hmm. MTV is not going to, they're not going to use that part of the information. Maybe they'll do a show about people who do that. But they can't sell that, so that's not going to come back. Really, what they want to do is figure out how they can get kids to buy the stuff they already have. They're looking for how to package something.
Mm-hmm.
How do we package a war to get America to agree with it? Not what does America want? Does America want to go to war?
That's a really good point. Douglas Rushkoff is our guest today on Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney. Doug Rushkoff is the author of many books, including the recent book, Open Source Democracy, and also Nothing Sacred, The Truth About Judaism. Let's go back to the phone lines. Line 1, Colorado, you're on the air with Douglas Rushkoff.
Hi, my name is Kendra from Colorado, of course.
We've got a toll-free number, Kendra, for future reference.
I'm calling from the toll-free number.
Oh, okay, great.
Yeah, I'm a big fan of money saving. So, I would like to ask, in particular address the presidential primary that we've been talking about here with Dean and Kucinich in general. In particular, I'm actually a really big Kucinich supporter, and one thing I've noticed is that this particular campaign has been focused so much on specifically Dean, but specifically Dean's use of the Internet. And actually, most of the time I open up an article in the paper, or anywhere else for that matter, about Howard Dean, it's almost nothing to do with who Howard Dean is and what he's for, and more than anything else to do with how he's using this tool. One thing I noticed during one of the primary debates was that the moderator brought up, basically spent the entire first few minutes of the debate talking about the Gore endorsement of Dean and the massive support that Dean has, and asked the other candidates to address that, whereas Kucinich, at his turn, actually said, why are we why are we talking about this? Why are we talking about the horse race? Why are we talking about the methods, and why can't we address the issues? And I'm wondering if you've noticed any focus, any more focus than there might. I mean, how much of this, the importance of this campaign, do you think is based on the use of the media?
All right. Well, thank you, caller. That's all right. Thank you very much. Yeah,
well,
Douglas.
I mean, in one sense, it's all media. It's very hard. It's very hard to distinguish between media and anything else. You know, because even our laws are a media through which we, you know, through which we attempt to organize ourselves or regulate ourselves. These are all media. I mean, in a sense, though, I guess the real question you're asking is when does the race itself overshadow whatever it was these people were supposed to be running on? And I think the reason why, one way we could see this kind of speculation as legitimate, is that we're talking about politics here. You know, we're not just talking about policies. We are looking at whether or not the Democrats, you know, in this case, whether or not the Democrats will be able to unseat the Republicans. And this is about power brokering. This is about something other, in a sense, other than what these individual people believe. Right now, from the Democratic perspective, from the Democrats' perspective, there's only one aim, and that is to unseat Bush. And the differences between the candidates, when you compare them to the view that the Democrats have, which is a sort of neoconservative, arch-conservative administration, it is about who's going to be our guy.
Yeah, Doug, let's see another way. It seems to me, and this gets to the point of your ebook, Open Source Democracy, that a lot of the appeal of Dean, as you pointed out, is less to do with Dean the person or Dean and his position on issues, as much as it is that people are enthralled by the way this guy's come on the scene and used the internet to generate popular support. And then I think that appeals to us that, well, maybe this guy's smart enough then doing that he can win a campaign in November and beat a Republican. So that appeals to many Democrats.
Right. I mean, because if you go back and look at the Gore-Bush election and how Gore lost after the election, that wasn't about policies. That was power brokering. You know, he lost in the courts, and he lost because his supporters weren't as violent, you know, as Bush's supporters in Florida. There are other things, in other words, and his use of media wasn't as powerful at that point. So in some ways, I think people on the Democratic side are looking at Dean as a kind of a savior who can use media in a new way. I mean, and that's what's won elections, you know, since they've been happening. You know, Lincoln was a better debater. You know, Kennedy was better on TV. Clinton was better in the Oprah Winfrey format, where Ross Perot, in some ways, was actually more advanced in his media. He was almost too advanced for America at that point, talking about electronic. Remember, he was talking about electronic
Sure.
town halls and talking about using the internet and taking out his own infomercials. So in some ways, it's more than fashion. From Dean, it does give people a sense of hope, and it is, even if it's not related to policy, it is real on a certain level in terms of the Democrats' ability to take the White House. So it's very, very interesting. But I am also concerned that it does overshadow the issues to the point where it feels like, you know, we're using media in a more intelligent or transparent way. But the whole race has gone meta, if you will. Now we're running on how we run rather than what we're running about.
Yeah. We're talking to Douglas Rushkoff today in Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney. We have a couple of callers who've been very patient. If you'd like to join us, the telephone number here is 333-9455. Our toll-free line is open, 1-800-222-9455. Let's go back to the phone lines. Vehement, you're on the air.
Yeah, hi. I just wanted to bring up a couple of things. One of them is something that I really like on the Internet and use quite a bit, which kind of ties into the trend on audio books, and that is radioforall.net. Hmm. And that's the requisite three W's, radio, the numeral four, and all, .net, and there you can find all kinds of progressive stuff ranging, and these are MP3s. You can either listen to them online or download them and burn them to CDs, and there's everything there from short satirical things and radical music to two-hour exegesis on obscure forms of anarchism.
All right.
Then the other thing I wanted to bring up has to do with, I really liked The Merchants of Cool. It was great. And I was just wondering, it seems to me that a lot of the people that would be really rah-rah Bush people and out yelling, we're number one in USA, USA, and maybe getting violent in Florida, you know, during that election thing, they really seem to be mooky people to me. Do you think that perhaps this idea of, that has had an effect on American politics, and I'll hang up now.
All right, thank you.
Yeah, definitely. I mean,
mooky people, is that what he said?
Mooks, yeah. Well, okay. We talked about two types of people in the documentary, that MTV seems to look at all boys as mooks and all girls as midriffs, so that it seems to be trying to say that, you know, that young men are like those shirtless guys on spring break going, hoo, 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 we're watching pro wrestling, that there's this sort of, you know, violent, oafish, you know, Tom Green, or, you know, these shows where they, you know, get run over by cars or whatever. There's this sort of archetype that they're pushing for guys. And then there's a Britney Spears sort of midriff exposed, stupid, but very sexual, a young teen girl that the girls are supposed to emulate. What I think the caller is talking about is hasn't that really extended this sort of mookishness or oafishness to the crowd, you know, to the mob, and is what we saw in Florida when the Republican side was sort of acting like a mob and frightening people from even counting the tallies. Or you see, from either side, whether it's these sort of, giant promise keepers rallies or a Farrakhan rally or a pro or anti, whatever, kind of a mob-like energy. In other words, I think what he's really asking is, are we moving towards a kind of a fascism in this country? And I mean, that's something that people have been asking for a while. You know, as the left dies, you know, what is on the other side of communism traditionally? Well, it turned out it was fascism. It is this other thing. I mean, when I wrote a novel called Exit Strategy here in the U.S., and it was about the dot-com boom, and I kind of coined this term market fascism, where it felt like if you said anything against the stock market, especially in the media, everybody came down on you for hurting the stock market by saying something bad about the market. So if you go on TV and say, I remember I would always say, oh, the boom's going to be over by the year 2000. You're wasting your money. This is all elevated. This is all, this is all hogwash. I would get these angry calls and emails saying, how dare you do that? You know, don't you know that you know, you can have an influence on the market by undermining it? This sort of mob mentality in the market, but I think it has translated somewhat to the political sphere, and it does worry me that I can go see, you know, a movie like Starship Troopers. I remember when that came out. It's this it's really a comment on fascism, and I see it with a bunch of people who just cheer, you know, who don't even get that this is a satire of Leni Riefenstahl and don't understand where this was coming from. It does worry me, and I do feel like, and this is largely a result of the sort of very angry top-down media from, you know, Rush Limbaugh right through all the stuff on you know, Fox News in the evening, that there is this sense that you just be a good white Christian American, you know, and close your ears to all the other talk, trust in your leaders, and you know, and go America. And that's the thing that gets scary to thinking people. You know, it's not that we don't like the American flag. It's that when we see the American flag on hundreds of thousands of SUVs going through our cities, we wonder what's the impulse that makes people put it on, and what they are thinking about people in other countries, what they do think about preemptive war, and why, you know, why only 23% of Americans believe in evolution, and why I think it's 62% of Americans think that Saddam Hussein had something to do with 9/11. You know, that's when I start to get worried about a mob mentality rather than an articulate body politic of people expressing their opinions, going online and finding out what's happening in the world.
We're talking to Douglas Rushkoff today on Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney. We have a few callers who've been very patient, and I want to get to them right now.
I'll shut up.
No, you don't. You dare. You keep it going, Douglas. You're doing great. Line one, Urbana, you're on the air with Douglas Rushkoff.
Hi, Bob, and hi, Douglas. I just wanted to bring into the discussion, I guess this might turn into another commercial here, but let's talk about indie media, perhaps, which is both an internet forum for debate, discussion, and news, but it also, I know in a lot of the cities around the world that indie media has a presence, and there are centers that encourage people to meet up there and, you know, get out of the armchair and actually, you know, encourages them to do, you know, to perform either direct action or at least, you know, get involved with their with their interested politics. So I guess I wanted to know, maybe to bring this back to the presidential discussion here, I mean, do you think that indie media will ever be a force to be reckoned with in, let's say, presidential politics or even in, you know, mainstream politics at all? I mean, it's grown pretty exponentially.
Caller, can I interrupt for just one second? Because I have a lot of listeners who might not be familiar with what you mean by indie media. They might just think you mean independent media in general. I think you're referring specifically to the online independent media centers, like the kind we have in Urbana-Champaign?
Right. Yeah, I am.
Okay, which is, you know, Doug, this really is something that would relate closely to the work you've been doing. What's your take on independent media centers and their future?
I mean, I think they work. What I'm interested in is, I guess there's a little-known effort, and I actually think it's going to be called, it might be called Media Matters, believe it or not.
Uh-oh, I'm going to sue them.
That the Democrats are partly funding and partly running as kind of as an answer to what they see as the sort of the wall of right-wing media, that what they want to do is just start exposing what's being said, transcribing Rush Limbaugh's show, you know, transcribing these things and putting them up, showing what the relations are between different people. So it's not reporting as much as almost publicizing everything that the right is already doing on mainstream media, but putting it up in such a way that people can actually go, oh my gosh, this is what they're saying, this is what this person said, you know, so that the sort of the current Republican strategy of going on tiny local radio shows rather than on national media in order to hit little audiences and not have their words really spread too far, to kind of break that and to show that there's a fax that comes out of the Heritage Foundation that then is sent and broadcast to all the right-wing jocks. There's only a small group that is interested in being as well-informed and as activist as those of us who frequent these sites are. You know, the question is whether or not these kinds of sites, these kinds of centers can activate us to make media that will be different. You know, whether it raises kids who come through high school and college who then get their job at Newsweek or U.S. News and World Report and write different kinds of articles. It's whether or not people start sourcing. You know, once people are sourcing a website, then its authority, you know, its authority changes. So, you know, on a certain level, I think it has. I'm as an independent media supporter, you know, we have to hit the mainstream. I mean, and the way to hit the mainstream is either through secondary media to have people writing articles about how interesting this kind of media is, or through the people who are exposed to it. It changes the way that they. That they make their media. But, I mean, I'm reminded of a place where I was really wrong. I was advising a little bit to Lego, and I really believed that their product that they were going to come out with called Mindstorms, which let kids program their own Lego toys, basically do Lego from the ground up with computers and all this, that this was going to be the big thing because kids really want to pop the hood and understand how things work. And it turns out that really only like 11 or 12% of kids are interested in how things work. And the other 80 or 90% of kids really just want toys they can play with. You know, they don't have that sort of natural inquisitiveness. And I think that translates into activism and real knowledge, too. I don't think a majority of people really want to know what's going on. And almost no amount of education is going to make them really want to. But for the 10 or 20% that do, I think it is key. I mean, and it changes. It can change the way we organize. It can change the way we argue so that if we are informed, then when we do go into the local bar or we are in our class or we are with our friends, we are more articulate. We have more facts at our disposal. We can actually change things by changing that other 80%. But I don't think that those sites do it directly.
Caller, do you have anything else you'd like to add?
Yeah, I would. I'd like to say that, well, you know, this is kind of my opinion, but I think that Indie Media actually has done both of those things that you talked about. They are actually getting secondary references in, you know, in some, you know, more progressive, smaller publications, mostly internet, but they do get a lot of references, a lot more than they have. And also, I think that they also provide, like I said, at the centers that are actually, you know, where people meet up face to face. They give a lot of opportunities for people that you know that really do just want to play around with the toys of the media. I mean, the media is sort of a toy in a lot of ways for a lot of people. It's just used pretty viciously by those who have it, in my opinion. But it gives the opportunity for people that haven't, you know, that haven't had these toys to play with. I mean, they give, you know, computer access to these people. They give them video cameras. They give them microphones. And you know, in a way, it's just encouraging them to play around with these things.
Well, thank you very much for calling in. I've got a couple other callers I want to get to before the hour is up. Let us now turn, if we can, to line four in Urbana. You're on the air with Douglas Rushkoff.
Hello.
Hello.
Hey. Yes, I love what you said about the media being the television, especially up till now, being the way that the Democrat has gotten his foot in the door. But if we look at the Democrat executives, starting with Kennedy, of course, very lovable, very attractive, a very attractive wife. Then we go to Johnson, stepping up after the assassination, in, you know, an attempt to save the West from dark communism, the insurgence of dark communism. Also very lovable. He didn't run, but also very lovable. When we look at the Democrats, Carter, smiled. He walked up to a young farmer friend of mine who was studying at Southern Illinois University, stuck his hand out with his entourage there, and said, "My name is Jimmy Carter. I'm running for president." And smiled at my friend. You see, we want a lovable candidate. If a candidate is not lovable, as a Democrat, I stand here saying to you, I'm not going to vote for him.
Okay. Douglas, would you vote for an unlovable Democrat?
Well, I've never really loved any of them. You know, what this guy said is very similar to something that the head of a big advertising agency said in an interview I did with him last week for a documentary, where, you know, this guy came up with this idea that instead of having you know, trademarks and instead of having brands, we're going to have love marks. And his point is that, and he's got this whole site called lovemarks.com, and his point is that people don't buy things intellectually, they buy things emotionally, and that it's always been that way and it always will, and the thing you need to do is to get people to fall in love with your product. I think the reason they're saying this is because, and I'm optimistic, is because things are changing, and the Internet is part of what's changed everything. The Internet gives people information on stuff. Now, it's not about, oh, I love to go into that store. It's, yeah, I love to go into that store to see the product. Then I love to go into the Internet and see who has it cheaper, you know? So, or yes, I want a computer, but I'm going to go online and see what the actual differences are between these things before I lay out the money. I'm going to look at the numbers. I think the thing that's confounding advertisers and marketers is that people aren't taking an interest now in these things called product attributes. It's something that they've ignored for decades, which is what does the thing do and how much does it cost? How does it work? What's the guarantee? And I think as we get more poor and as products get more complex, I think these things are going to start to matter to us a little bit more. And if it's mattering to us in the land of products, then it's going to start mattering to us in the land of candidates. You know, we may live in a consumer democracy, but if people at least become educated consumers, they're going to start to wonder, well, what is this guy's position on, say, gun control or abortion or taxes? At least, you know, three or four biggies for themselves is better than just love. When they get in the voting booth and have to push that lever, does there need to be an emotional connection with the candidate? Maybe, maybe, but I don't think that people loved young Bush when they were voting for him. I think that maybe they felt safe. Maybe there was still some emotional connection, but it would be very encouraging if a few other things started to enter into people's decision-making process that involved just a little bit of their cognition. You know, and Dean has all these smart people working with him. I'm sure by the time it got to a national candidacy, they'll figure out how to make him lovable too.
Doug, we've got time for one more caller today on Media Matters, so let's go back to the phone lines. Line 2, Edgar County, you're on the air with Douglas Rushkoff.
Good afternoon. Back in the late 50s when I was at the University of Illinois and working in TV under the stadium where it all began, I got interested in public relations, which was a very new thing then, and I got into it. It became my profession. What is being practiced today is sophistry. The ends justify the means. They will do anything, say anything, and then as easily switch in order to continue. Tony Blair did it today in Iraq. He now is not talking about anything about war, you know, development of you know, missiles or things such as that. He's talking about what Saddam did to the Iraqis, you know. The pathos is being appealed to. It's not logos. It's not even, it's definitely not ethos. And so you end up with a shallow sophistication, and I don't know whether I agree with you about people go into depth to find out. A certain percentage do, but a large percentage go on their gut instinct of how they feel and how warm they are. And that's all they have to feel is warm to somebody.
Do you think that emotional response can work? If people are angry, would they vote for an angry candidate? Does that happen, or does it always come back?
No, I think you have to watch the anger. The smile is important. Calvin Coolidge couldn't win, you know, if he bought all the votes in the country. You know, it's a situation that you have to set up this image, and it doesn't matter what's behind it. It's like the Wizard of Oz. You know, I'm really listening to myself and thinking, I'm terribly pessimistic about all this. But unfortunately, in the last several years, I have really become pessimistic that I don't know whether we have control.
Sir, are you still working in public relations?
No, I reached that golden age, and where I only do consulting, and I'll be honest with you, I knew Edward Bernays. He apologized for giving women the opportunity to smoke, and there's a couple things which I'm going to have to, you know, answer for my sins. Promotion, but you know, I taught public relations at New York University and Pace University, and you know, I came to the understanding that what was happening out there wasn't what was going to be the truth. you know, and I'm not a, I don't want to be a radical. I'm conservative on many matters, but yet at the same time, we haven't got any control. And you talk, it's wonderful to surf the internet and find various blogs and such that and media matters and all of that, but who has the power? That's the point.
Well, caller, thank you very much for calling in. We've only got a little bit of time left. I'd like to let Douglas Rushkoff answer.
Okay, thank
all right,
you.
Certainly. Douglas?
It's tricky. On the one hand, I can paint it negatively. You know, that you know, you walk into the Gap, say, and there's some 16-year-old girl there who's going to use stuff she learned on a videotape, you know, that the Gap plays for her, how to get you to buy a belt and socks and other stuff you don't need along with those jeans that maybe you did. And you can blame this on this girl, you know, because she's using, you know, coercive techniques on you. Or you can say, look, it's not her fault. It's the store manager's fault because they'll dock her pay and fire her if she doesn't get enough three-item sales every day. So then you blame the store manager. But the store manager's got a quota, too. You know, the regional director will come down on her. You know, so then you blame the regional director. Well, yeah, but they're answering to the marketing department. The marketing department's demanding better numbers. So you blame it on the marketer. You think, well, yeah, but the marketer's just listening to the, you know, senior vice president, and the senior vice president's just listening to the CEO, and the CEO is just listening to the chairman of the board. The chairman of the board is just listening to the other board members who are just listening to the shareholders, who is the same person that walked into the store who happens to have the Gap in his 401k plan. You know, so who has the power? In one sense, none of us do, because we're all part of this system that seems to exploit us constantly. But on the other hand, I would argue that any person in the chain has the power to arrest it. You know, I do by deciding not to buy this thing, or by speaking the truth to the girl in the Gap. The girl in the Gap does by deciding, I just can't do this job. So does her manager. So does the regional director. So I think at any point along the chain, if there are people who, they don't have to stick their head out the window and say, I'm mad as hell, I'm not going to take it anymore. But what they have to do is decide they're not going to participate in this machine, that we are in charge of it. Corporations are not in charge of our world. Corporations are pieces of paper with a set of rules written down that we follow or we don't follow. If those aren't the rules we want, then it's our job to get in and rewrite them.
Doug, on that note, I think I'm going to have to call a halt to it. I hear the band tuning up in the background.
Okie doke.
That means it's time for me to get out of here. Douglas Rushkoff, author of the new book, Open Source Democracy, and also the book, Nothing Sacred, The Truth About Judaism, has been our guest today in Media Matters. Thank you so much for joining us, Doug.
Well, thanks for having me. It's been an honor.
We'll get you again some other time. I want to thank Victor Picard, our wonderful producer, for being back in town. And see you all 1 week from today. Ciao.